Chapter 4. At least the ship has steerage way, said Jack, taking off his shirt and trousers and placing them in the hammock netting well clear of the trail of shining scales. I do so loathe plunging into the accumulated filth of 3 days and nights. Ain't you coming? With your leave, I shall attend to the anatomy of this noble fish. Mr. Martin, how do you do? Before the slightest change sets in. You can't have the deck above 30 minutes, Doctor, said Pullings. This is a saluting day, you know, and everything has to be tolerable neat. Mr. Reed, my dear, said Stephen, may I beg you to jump downstairs and bid Padin bring me the large dissecting case, and then go forward and tell the little girls to bear a hand, to lend a hand, but in their old dirty pinafores. Their old dirty pinafores had already been put to soak. New pinafores were out of the question. They came aft naked as worms, their small black figures exciting no comment, since they were in and out of the water much of the day in this calm weather. They were valuable assistants with their little neat strong hands, their total lack of squeamishness. They would seize a ligament with their teeth if need be. Their ability to hold almost as well with their toes as their fingers, and their eagerness to please. Padin was useful, too, in heaving on the very heavy parts, and even more in warding off Davies, the ship's cook, the gunroom cook, the captain's cook, the ship's butcher, and all their respective mates, who were urgent to have their pieces out of the sun and into the relatively cool part of the ship or the salting tubs. For swordfish was like mackerel in these latitudes, mate, prime before sunset, porridge on the second day, and rank poison the third. But with all their dispatch, and the seamen hurried off with their prizes the moment they were released by the anatomists, they were not hasty enough for Pullings. He'd already sent the gunroom's compliments to Mr. and Mrs. Oakes and would be honoured by their presence at dinner, while Jack had accepted even before diving. The first lieutenant, therefore, had to set everything in train for a feast that would make up for the long delay, and at the same time he had to prepare the ship, dressed all over, for the grave ritual of saluting the 5th of November. He and the boatswain had, of course, laid aside great quantities of bunting and streamers, but they knew very well that nothing could be sent aloft until everything below was so clean that a maiden could eat her dinner off of it. Until all guns in their carriages were spotless, until what little unpainted brass the ship possessed outshone the sun, until the whole catalogue of tasks had been carried out, all of them calling for great activity. Early in these strenuous preparations, Stephen handed the fishy little girls over the side, and having seen them thoroughly dipped, and having learnt from Jemmy Ducks that their divisional pinafores were ready for the ceremony, he hurried aft, drawn by the scent of coffee, to have breakfast with Jack, who had also invited West and Reed. It was a pleasant meal, yet with so much to be done, none of the sailors lingered. Stephen followed them on deck, but at the sight of the turmoil he retired to his cabin, and there, having smoked a small paper cigar out of the scuttle, he sat to his desk, reflected for a while, and then wrote, "My dearest love, when I was a child and had to have my paper ruled for me, I used to begin my letters, 'I hope you are quite well, I am quite well.' There the muse would often leave me. Yet, even so, as a beginning, it has its merits. I hope you are very well indeed, and as happy as ever can be. Come in," he cried. Killick opened the door, laid Stephen's best uniform, cocked hat and sword on the table with a significant look, nodded, and walked off. "When last I sat at this desk," continued Stephen, "I was telling you, if I do not mistake, about Mrs. Oakes. But I think I never described her. She is a slim, fair-haired young woman, a little less than the average size, with a slight figure, grey-blue eyes, and an indifferent complexion that I hope will be improved by steel and bark. Her chief claim to beauty is an excellent, unstudied carriage, not unlike yours. As for her face... But where faces are concerned, what can description do? All I will say is that hers reminds me of an amiable young cat. No whiskers, no furry ears, to be sure, but something of the same triangularity, poise and sloping eyes. Its expression, though modest, is open and friendly, indeed markedly friendly, as though she were eager, if not for downright affection, then at least for general liking. This, or even both, she has certainly acquired. And a curious proof of the fact is that whereas some time ago all hands were intensely eager to know what crimes or misdemeanours had brought her to Botany Bay, she is now no longer troubled with any of the ill-bred hints that she at one time dismissed with a firmness that I admired. I believe that the very curiosity itself has died away, she being accepted as a person belonging to the ship. The question of guilt or reprobation is quite left aside. She is, there is no doubt at all, good company, willing to be pleased, taking an unfeigned interest in naval actions. I was there when West gave her a detailed account of Camperdown, and I'm sure she followed every stroke, and she never interrupts. She never interrupts. Yet I must insist that there is nothing in the least forward or provocative or inviting about her manner, nothing whatsoever of the flirt. She doesn't put out for admiration, and although some of the officers feel called upon to say gallant things, she doesn't respond in kind. No protestation, no simpering, a civil smile is all. Indeed, I should say that she is in general much less aware of her sex than those she's with. And this I say with the more confidence since I've sat with her for hours, right through the afternoon watch, for example, when her husband was on duty and I was looking out for Latham's albatross, or on occasion through much of the night when it is close below and fresh on deck. We have few things in common. She knows little about birds, beasts or flowers, little about music. And although she has read a certain amount, no one could call her a barbleu. Yet we talk away in a most companionable manner. And through all our conversations, by day or by night, I might have been talking to a modest, agreeable, quite intelligent young man. Though few young men I know are more conciliating, more willing to be liked, and none more capable of resisting intrusion on his privacy. Without being in the slightest degree what is called mannish, she is as comfortable a companion as a man. You may say that this is because I am no Adonis, which is very true, but unless I mistake, it is the same with Jack. On those rare occasions when he comes to exchange the time of day. The same with Davidge, a more constant attendant, and both are reckoned tolerably good-looking men. Tom Pullings and West, whose nose mortified on the outward voyage, are even less lovely than I am. They are treated with the same friendliness. So is one-eyed Martin, though he, poor fellow, is not always discreet, and has sometimes seen the cold side of the moon, the Medea I spoke of long ago. Whether this unguarded friendliness is very wise, or, in the event, very kind, I do not know. Men are sadly apt to misinterpret such conduct, and even when no masculine vanity or self-love steps in, a tenderness may arise in some bosoms, I fear. A tenderness, or perhaps something with a grosser name in certain cases, or a mixture of the two in yet others. For after all, the lady came aboard in circumstances that could never be called ambiguous, and even the faintest remains of a bad reputation are wonderfully stimulating. Dear Jack, who is not insensible to her charms, keeps very much aloof. But to my astonishment, I find that he is anxious for my peace of mind, for my peace of mind. Some of his more obscure general remarks upon human happiness became clear to me on Tuesday, when he surprised me extremely by repeating the sonnet that begins "The Expense of Spirit," saying it in his deep voice better than I thought he could possibly have done, and ending, "All this the world well knows, but none knows well to shun the heaven that leads men to this hell, with the fine sullen growl it calls for, generally in vain. I was transfixed. And the words savage, extreme, rude, cruel, not to trust, echoed strangely in my mind. The bell tells me that I shall see the lady in 5 minutes, unless she sends to cry off, which is not unlikely, she being to dine with the gunroom today. And although she may have some manly virtues, I'm sure she's woman enough to spend some hours dressing for a feast, so I shall leave this sheet unfinished. Stephen was not infallible. He was by no means infallible. The tap at his door 5 minutes later was his patient, true to her hour. The coming feast had brought some colour into her cheeks, and she looked very well. But in point of fact, he found neither improvement nor deterioration in her physical state. And when the examination was over, he said, "We must persevere with the steel and bark. I believe I shall increase the dose a trifle, and I shall also send a little wine forward to be drunk medicinally. A glass at noon and 2 glasses in the evening." "How very kind," said Clarissa, her voice muffled in the folds of her dress. And again he reflected that she took no more notice of her nakedness than if they had both been men. Perhaps this was because he was a physician and didn't count. Yet most of his few women patients had made some gestures in the direction of modesty. Clarissa made none, any more than a professional painter's model would have done. But when her head emerged and she'd buttoned herself and smoothed her hair, she said with a certain awkwardness, "Dear doctor, may I beg you to do me another kindness? Nothing to do with medicine." Stephen bowed and smiled, and she went on, "Something disagreeable happened yesterday. Mr. Martin was showing me how to tune the viola when his little cat, you know his little cat? The little cat's mother had joined the ship in Sydney Cove and had been tolerated so long by Jack in the Dust, she was a good mouser, that it was thought inhuman to turn her ashore when she proved to be in kit. And Martin had adopted this survivor from the litter, a stupid, persecuting animal." Stephen bowed again. "Well, it suddenly jumped on my lap, as it so often does. I dislike cats, and I pushed it off, perhaps a little harder than usual. 'Oh,' cries he, 'do not be unkind to my little cat, I beg. Were you not brought up with cats? Were there no cats at home when you were a child?' And a whole string of inquiries. As you know, I dislike questions as much as I dislike cats, and I may have answered him a little sharply." "Perhaps you did, my dear. And I'm afraid he may think I'm still cross. But what is worse, the wretched creature disappeared last night, and he may possibly imagine that I threw it overboard. Please would you seat him next to me at dinner? I should be so sorry if we weren't friends." Stephen, feeling that his eyes might betray his reflections, looked down and said in a neutral voice, "I have no say in these things. Pullings is the president of our mess, but I will mention it to him if you choose." Another tap at the door, and this time it was Reed, bringing the captain's compliments. If Dr. Maturin should wish to attend the ceremony, he had between 4 and 5 minutes in which to change. The message was delivered in an embarrassed mumble. And when Mrs. Oakes asked Reed whether her husband was already on deck, he flushed and said, "Yes, ma'am," neither smiling at her nor looking at her, which was in so great a contrast to his usual attitude of open admiration that each gave him a quick, penetrating glance. Stephen, however, had little time for quick, penetrating glances. Killick was fuming there at the door, and even before Mrs. Oakes was quite out of the room, he'd whipped Stephen's greasy old coat off. A steady stream of nagging reproach. Dr. Maturin, properly uniformed, was propelled up the companion ladder to the quarterdeck as the noon observation was in progress. He was somewhat astonished first by the flood of midday light after the shaded cabin, and then by the colours all about him, high, low, and on every hand, a variety of reds and yellows and blues, square, oblong, triangular, swallow-tail, checkered, strangely brilliant after the eternal blue or grey, for the ship was now dressed over all. A splendid sight under a most luminous and perfect sky. There was just enough breeze to waft out all the flags and streamers that clothed the masts, yards and rigging, a startling multitude of them blazing away there in the sun. The whole ship, too, was very fine, a hammock cloth stretched to a gleaming white unwrinkled smoothness, everything exactly as a sailor could wish it, decks, guns, falls, a quarter-deck alive with gold lace, the gangways and forecastle filled with hands in high Sunday rig duck trousers, bright blue brass-ribboned jackets, embroidered shirts, ribboned hats. "Make it 12, Mr. West," said Jack, noon being reported to him, and his words were still floating in the air when 8 bells struck. But whereas they were ordinarily followed by the bosun's pipe to dinner and a wholehearted bedlam of cries and trampling feet and thumping mess kids, now there was a total silence, all hands looking attentively aft. "Carry on, Mr. West," said Jack. "Away aloft," cried West. And the mass of the frigate's people raced up the shrouds on either side in a swift and even flow. "Lay out, lay out," called West, and they ran out on the yards. When the last light young fellow was right at the end of the starboard fore-topgallant yardarm, holding on by the lift, Jack stepped forward, and in a voice to be heard in heaven, he uttered the words, "Three cheers for the King!" "You must pull off your hat and call out huzzay," whispered Pullings into Stephen's ear. The doctor was staring about him in a very vacant manner.
"Huzzay! Huzzay! Huzzay!"
The cheers pealed out like so many rolling broadsides. And after the last, nothing could be heard but Sarah and Emily beside themselves with glee, who huzzayed on and on, "Huzzay, huzzay for Guy Fawkes!" very shrill, until Jemmy Duck suppressed them. "Mr. Smith," said Jack, "carry on." And the gunner, in his good black Presbyterian elder's coat, stepped forward with a red-hot poker in his hand. The salute, beginning with Jack's own brass bow-chaser, came solemnly aft on either side at exact 5-second intervals, the gunner pacing from one to the other with the ritual words, "If I wasn't a gunner, I wouldn't be here. Fire 7. When he'd reached fire 17, he turned aft and took off his hat. Jack returned his salute and said, "Mr. West, the hands may be piped to dinner." A last wild, long-drawn-out cheer, and before the white clouds of smoke had rolled a cable's length to leeward, the usual midday hullabaloo rose to a splendid pitch. By land in the northern parts of Ireland I've seen the 5th of November celebrated with fireworks, observed Stephen. "Nothing can exceed the cannon's noble roar," said the gunner. "Squibs and burning tar-barrels, even skyrockets at 0.5 crown apiece, is mere frippery in comparison of a well-loaded gun." Since he was to take the afternoon watch, thus releasing the whole gun-room for their feast, he was now on the quarter-deck, and turning to Jack, he said, "Well, sir, me and my mate will take our bite now, with your leave, and be on deck in 0.5 glass. Are there any special instructions?" "No, Mr. Smith. Only that I am to be told of any considerable change in the breeze and, of course, of any sail or land." 0.5 glass went by, and then, apart from the gunner and his mate and the men at the wheel, the quarter-deck was empty. Stephen and Padin had carried up 2 dozen of a pale sherry that had survived the voyage to Botany Bay, entrusting them to the gunroom steward. Stephen had spoken of Mrs. Oakes's wish to poor anxious Pullings, had shown the gunroom steward's mate an unusually elegant way of folding napkins, had proposed decorating the table with seaweed, producing examples, and had been desired by all his messmates, their differences temporarily overlooked, to go and watch for his Latham's albatross until four bells. There really wasn't room for so many people to mill about in so confined a space. Besides, it consumed what little fresh air there was. Martin had already gone into the mizzen-top, carrying his silk stockings in his pocket. Stephen wandered aft to where the captain was taking his ease in the great cabin, stretched out on the stern window locker with one foot in a basin of water. "Do you suffer, brother?" he asked, "or is this part of the Navy's superstitious horror of the unclean?" "I suffer, Stephen," said Jack, "but moderately. Do you remember how I stood on the dumb shoulder when Dick Richards and I cleared the Nutmeg's rudder?" "The dumb shoulder? Sure, I think of it constantly. It's rarely from my mind." "Well, it gave me a shrewd knock, and I limped for weeks, and just now I caught my ankle against the linchpin there, hitting it in just the same place. How I roared!" "I'm sure you did. Will they look at it now?" Stephen took the foot in his hands, considered it, pressed it, heard the catch of breath, and said, "It's a little small piece of the external malleolus trying to come out." "What is the external malleolus? Nay, if you can oppress me with your dumb shoulders, I can do the same with my malleoli. Hold still. Should you like me to take it out now? I've a lancet over there among the seaweed." "Perhaps we might wait until after the feast," said Jack, who very much disliked being cut in cold blood. "It feels much better now. I put a great deal of salt into the water." Stephen was used to this. He nodded, mused for a while, and said, "So the gunner has the watch. Tell me, Jack, is it not very amazingly strange that a gunner should have a watch?" "Oh, Lord, no. In a frigate it's unusual, of course. But in many a sloop, with only one lieutenant, many an unrated ship, it's quite common for a steady, experienced bosun or gunner to stand his watch. And in our case, there is an embarras de choix." "I said there's an embarras de choix." "I'm sure of it," said Stephen absently. "So many of our Shelmerstonians understand navigation of even commanded vessels of their own that if the whole quarterdeck were wiped out, God forbid, they could still carry the barkey home." "That's a great comfort to me. Thank you, Jack. Now I believe I shall go and read for a while." In the coach, Stephen spread out his authorities, Wiseman, Clare, Petit, Van Schuyten, John Hunter. They were prolix about men, but although they had little to say about women, they all agreed that there was no diagnosis more difficult than in those cases where the physician was confronted with a deep-seated, atypical, chronic infection. He was still reading Hunter with the closest attention when the bell told him he must join his messmates to welcome the gunroom's guests. The gunroom was almost silent, in a state of high anxiety, with West and Adams both frowning at their watches. "There you are, Doctor," cried Tom Pullings. "I was afraid we might have lost you, that you might have taken a tumble down the ladder like poor Davidge here, or fallen out of the top like Mr. Martin. Do you think the table looks genteel?" "Uncommon genteel," said Stephen, glancing up and down its geometrical perfections. He noticed Davidge standing by the far end, his hand to his head. Davidge caught his eye, stretched his mouth in a smile, and said, "I took a toss down the companion ladder." "The bride sits on my right hand, in course," said Pullings, "and then Martin, then you, and then Reed. Mr. Adams at the foot, the captain on my left, then Davidge. You're all right, Davidge, aren't you?" "Oh, yes, it's nothing." "Then West, and then Oakes on Mr. Adams' right. What do you think of that, Doctor?" "A capital arrangement, my dear," said Stephen, reflecting that Davidge's nothing was a damned heavy, turgid, uncomfortable one. A dark swelling from his left temple to his cheekbone. "I do wish they would come," said Pullings. "The soup is sure to spoil." And West looked at his watch again. The door opened. Killick walked in, said to Pullings, 2 minutes, sir, if you please," and took up his place against the side, behind Jack's chair. Martin edged his way round, and with a decently restrained triumph he said, "Do not beat me, Maturin, but I have seen your bird." "Oh," cried Stephen, "have you indeed? And I wearing out the day watching, are you sure?" "There can be no doubt, I'm afraid. Yellow, blue-tipped bill, a strong dark eyebrow, a confiding expression, and black feet. He was within 10 yards of me. Well, whoever said the world was fair? But I'm sorry to hear that you fell out of the top." "That was a base slander. In my hurry to come down and tell you, my foot made a trifling slip, and I've hung for a moment or two by my hands, perfectly safe, perfectly in control. And if the well-meaning John Brampton hadn't heaved me up by main force, I should have regained the platform with ease. In any event, I came down entirely unaided." Stephen sniffed and said, "Please to describe the bird." "Well," said Martin, and then stopped to turn and bow to Captain Aubrey. The gunroom welcomed their guest, pressed him to take a whet. Davidge once again explained that he had taken a toss on the companion ladder, and Pullings told Jack that he was uneasy about the soup. Those near the door listened attentively for the Oakes' coming. But in this case there would be no steps on the ladder down to warn them, as it had warned them of Jack's approach, since the midshipmen's berths, one of which the Oakses inhabited, were only a short way along the passage that led from the gunroom door forward to the great screened-off expanse of the lower deck, deserted now, where the foremast hands slung their hammocks. Even so, Adam's quick ear caught the swish of silk, and he opened the door to the splendid scarlet glow that Stephen had never yet beheld. "Upon my honour, ma'am," he said when it was his turn to greet her, "I have never seen you look so well. You fairly light up our dim and shabby dining room." "Dim and shabby dining room," said the gunroom steward to Killick in a sea-going whisper. "Did you ever hear such wickedness?" "That is what we call a genteel compliment," said Killick, "which it ain't meant to be believed." "It is all due to Captain Aubrey's kindness," she said, smiling and bowing to Jack as she sat down. "Never was such glorious silk." The sound of chairs being drawn in, the arrival of the swordfish soup and the ladling of it out, filled the gunroom with the pleasant confusion of sounds usual at the beginning of a feast, but presently they began to die away. The ill-feeling between Davidge and West was so great that even now, with their captain present, they barely exchanged a word. Oakes, always more at home in a pot-house, was even more than usually mute, a dogged look on his pale face. Reed, on Stephen's right, answered with no more than, "Yes, sir," "No, sir," looking quite pitifully sad, whilst on his left Martin maintained his reserved, though perfectly correct, attitude towards Clarissa throughout the soup. Stephen, Adams, and to some extent West made a reasonable amount of noise at the far end of the table about swordfishes they had known, the different kinds of swordfish, the inveterate enmity between the swordfish and the whale, instances not only of ships but even ships' boats being pierced, and the anguish of those sitting on the bottom between the thwarts. Jack and Pullings found a good deal to say about tunny in the Mediterranean, where the sides to Clarissa about the Sicilian and Moorish way of catching them. The subject, however, had its limits. And although both Jack and Pullings would have been happy to engage Mrs. Oakes, they were a little shy of doing so. There was the relief of taking soup plates away with a fine mess deck clatter and bringing on the swordfish fritters. And during the interval, both Stephen and Jack reflected upon the amount of ordinary dinner-table conversation taken up by "Do you remember?" or "Were you ever at?" or "You probably know Mr. Blank?" or, as I dare say you're aware, questions or implied questions that might offend the lady, or by personal recollections in which she never indulged. Stephen, Jack, and even more Pullings felt the awful approach of silence, and Jack, for one, turned to his infallible standby, "A glass of wine, will you, ma'am?" Infallible, but not long-lasting. And he was grateful when West made some sudden, prepared observations about the sawfish. Stephen took up this creature, such was the table's indigence, and compelled both Oakes and Reed to acknowledge that they had seen its mummified head in an apothecary's shop in Sydney, and had speculated on the use of the saw. Halfway through the fritters, he found, to his relief, that Clarissa, who was not only beautifully dressed, but who was also in looks, with colour in her cheeks and sparkling eyes, Clarissa, who had laid herself out to be amiable throughout the soup, had by now won her point. Martin's reserve had been overcome, and they were talking away at a great rate. "Oh, Mr. West," she called across the table, "I was going to tell Mr. Martin about your particular share in the glorious 1st of June, but I'm sure I'd make some foolish landlubber's blunder. May I beg you to do it for me?" "Well, ma'am," said West, smiling at her, "since you desire it, I will, though it don't redound much to my credit." He considered, emptied his glass, and went on, "Everybody knows about the glorious 1st of June." "I'm sure I do not," said Stephen, "and Mr. Reed may not either. He wasn't born at the time." Roused from his unhappiness for a moment, Reed looked at him reproachfully, but said nothing. "And I only know that you were wounded," said Clarissa. "Well, ma'am," said West, "just the most general lines, for those who may not have been born, who may never have seen a fleet action." This was aimed at Davidge, who, until Jack took him aboard the Surprise, had seen very little action of any kind. His only acknowledgement of the hit was to drain his glass. "In May of the year 94, then, the Channel Fleet put to sea from Spithead, with Earl Howe in command, the Union at the main. The wind had come round into the northeast at last, and we all got underway directly. 49 men of war, and the 99 merchants that had gathered at St. Helens, the East and West Indies convoys, and those for Newfoundland. An uncommon sight, ma'am. 148 sail of ships." "Glorious, glorious!" cried Clarissa, clasping her hands with unfeigned enthusiasm, and all the sailors looked at her with pleasure and approval. "So we tore down the channel, and off the Lizard we sent the convoys away with 8 line-of-battle ships and 6 frigates to look after them. 6 of those ships of the line were to cruise in the bay for a very important French convoy from America. That left Lord Howe with 26 of the line and 7 frigates. We lay off Ushant. I was a youngster in his flagship, the Queen Charlotte, at the time, while a frigate looked into Brest. She saw the Frenchmen, 25 of the line, lying in the roads. So we cruised a while in thick weather, looked in again, and they were gone. Some recaptured prizes told us where they were heading. And since the 6 ships cruising in the bay were strong enough to deal with the French convoy, Lord Howe pursued the French fleet with a great press of sail. But it was light, variable airs nearly all that time, and thick weather, and we didn't catch sight of them until the morning of May the 28th. 26 of the line now, directly to windward. Well, they bore down to about 9 miles from us and formed their line ahead directly to windward. But they had the weather gauge. And seeing they didn't seem very anxious to use it in attack, all we could do was to work to windward and harass them as much as possible. The Admiral sent 4 of the most weatherly ships forward, and there was something of an action. There was another the next day, when we did manage to get to windward of them, though in no very good order, and too late in the afternoon to force any decisive battle. We had quite a sea running, and the Charlotte, with her lower deck ports little more than 4 foot from the surface, shipped so much water she had to pump all night, and her mizzen yard was so wounded that for a while she couldn't tack. The day after that, the weather grew thicker and thicker. The French disappeared. And although the Admiral threw out the signal for our van ships to keep close order, there were times when you couldn't see your second ahead or astern. But, however, it cleared a little by 9 the next morning. This was the 31st, ma'am. And we saw how scattered we were. It was a very horrid sight. And we were very much afraid we'd lost the Frenchmen. They came in sight about noon. Some fresh ships had joined them, and as some of the ships hadn't behaved very sensibly in the last engagement, Black Dick... We called the Admiral Black Dick, ma'am, but though it sounds disrespectful, it wasn't so in fact, was it, sir? Oh, dear me, no, said Jack. He was affectionate, but I shouldn't have dared use it to his face. No. Well, Black Dick decided against an action that might last until darkness, and he hauled to the wind, steering the course he judged the French would follow. He was quite right. At dawn, there they were on our starboard bow, about 2 leagues to leeward, in line of battle on the larboard tack. Moderate sea, breeze steady in the south by west. We bore down and then hauled to the wind again at 7, 4 miles from them. The Admiral signalled that he should attack the enemy's centre, that he should pass through the enemy's line and engage to leeward. Then we had breakfast. Lord, how I enjoyed my burgoo. When that was et, we filled and bore down under single reef topsails in line abreast. They were in a close head and stern formation. Sir, whispered the gunroom steward in Pulling's ear, Cook says if we don't eat our swordfish steaks this selfsame minute he'll hang himself. I've been signalling, Your Honour, this last half hour. The steaks arrived in style, the dishes covering the middle of the table, while in the intervals and at the corners there were small bowls of such things as dried peas, beaten into a paste with a marlin spike and flavoured with turmeric, and white sauce beautified with cochineal. Davy's dreadful, whiskered face could be seen in the doorway, leering in. He'd arranged all the dishes by hand. Martin was an accomplished anatomist, and Stephen noticed that he helped Mrs. Oakes to some particularly tender pieces with great complacence. He also noticed that Reed was filling his glass every time the wine came within reach. I had no idea that swordfish could be so very good, said Clarissa, above the sound of knives and forks. I'm so happy you like it, ma'am, said Pullings. May I pour you a glass of wine? Just half a glass, Captain, if you please. I long to hear the rest of Earl Howe's battle. After a decent reluctance and encouragement by most of the table, West said, I'm afraid I've been far too long-winded, but now, rather than try to describe the whole battle, I shall only say that when their line was perfectly clear, the Admiral rearranged our heavy ships to match theirs, and so we bore down each to steer for her opposite number, break their line, and engage her independently from to leeward. Well, some did, and some did not, but everyone knows we took 6 of them, sunk one, crippled many more, and lost none of our own, though it was nip and tuck at times, they fighting with such spirit. So having said that, may I just speak of a few things I saw? For I was on the quarter-deck, acting as our first lieutenant's runner, and some of the time I stood quite close to the Admiral's chair. You must understand, ma'am, that Lord Howe was a very ancient gentleman, 70, if I don't mistake, and he sat there in a wooden elbow chair. Now, our opposite number was, of course, the French Admiral's flagship, the Montagne of 120 guns, and her next astern was the Jacobin of 80. They started firing at 9:30, but as the wind was blowing from us to them, their smoke rolled away to leeward, so we could see them perfectly well, and the Admiral, setting to gallants and forecourse, aimed for the gap between them, meaning to pass through, luff up on the Montagne's starboard side and fight her yardarm to yardarm. But when we were within pistol shot, the Jacobin, disliking the idea of being raked by our starboard guns as we broke through the line ahead of her, began to move up into the Montagne's lee. "Starboard!" calls the Admiral, in spite of the Jacobins being in the road. "My lord, you'll be foul of the French ship if you don't take care," says Mr. Bowen, the master. The master, ma'am, handles the ship in battle. "What's that to you, sir?" cries the Admiral. "Starboard!" "Damned if I care if you don't," says old Bowen, but not very loud. "I'll take you near enough to singe your black whiskers." He clapped the helm harder starboard, and the ship just scraped through, the Montagne's ensign brushing the Charlotte's shrouds, and the Charlotte's bowsprit grazing the Jacobins as she flinched away. And then, lying on the Montagne's quarter, we raked her again and again, at the same time battering the Jacobins with our starboard broadside. We mauled them terribly, blood gushing from the scuppers, but presently we lost our foretopmast, chaos forward, and they were able to make sail from us into the great bank of smoke to leeward. The rest of their line was breaking too, and the Admiral threw out the signal for a general chase. After that, everything grew more confused, of course, but I remember very well that late in the afternoon I received my only wound. The First Lieutenant had just jumped down into the waist, and the Admiral said to me, "Go and tell Mr. Cochet to make the forecastle guns stop firing at that ship. She's the Invincible." I went down and we ran forward. "Stop firing at Invincible," says Mr. Cochet. "But she's not Invincible. She's a French ship that has been firing at us all along," said Mr. Codrington. And Mr. Hale agrees. "I know that," said Mr. Cochet. "Let's have a shot." The gun was run in, sponged, loaded, ran out. He pointed it just so, waited for the roll, waited again, and fired. The shot went home. And as the smoke cleared, said West with a sideways glance at Jack, there was the Admiral. "God damn you all," he cries, hitting Mr. Hale. He thought Hale had fired the shot with the flat of his sword. "God damn you all," fetching me a swipe on the top of my head. Then the ship, hauling her wind, showed her French colours. And Cochet, to save the Admiral's face, said she's painted just like the Invincible, but... For some time now, as the Veracity left West's account, the ship had been heeling more and more. To counteract the lean, those to windward, those on pulling's right, braced their feet against the stretcher. But Reed's legs were too short to reach it, and he slid quietly under the table, his eyes shut, his face pale. Stephen glanced at Pardeen, who lifted the boy out and carried him away as easily as he might have carried off the folded cloth when it was drawn. There was no fuss, no comment, and West didn't pause in his narrative. Jack listened with half an ear, grateful for the sound, but wishing that it might be replaced with something of greater interest. He was not a censorious man. He didn't mind West's fiction, which he recognised as being composed for Mrs. Oakes's benefit, any more than he minded Reed's collapse. But West was ordinarily the soul of truth, and his fiction was poor. Embarrassingly poor, as well as far, far too long. It was with some relief, therefore, that he saw the long-expected messenger from the quarterdeck appear in the doorway. The gunner's mate looked into the gunroom and its formal array, hesitated for a moment, and then strode aft as if he were going into action. "Gunner's duty, sir," he said very loud, bending over Jack, "and the breeze is freshening. May he reduce sail?" "Certainly, Mellon. Tell him I'm very glad to hear it, and that I desire he will use his own judgment." "Aye, aye, sir. He's very glad to hear it, and desires he will use his own judgment." "Will use his own judgment in it, sir." "I'm very glad to hear it," said Jack to the table at large. "We've been creeping over a mill pond far too long, and the hands have been idle all this time." A childhood memory to do with Satan and idle hands floated there, but he couldn't quite fix it, and ended with the unuttered words, "Not only the hands, not a god damn the wicked dogs." It was some time since he'd dined with the gunroom. The last occasion had been rather a dull afternoon. Davidge and West were always in different company, their conversation either shop or twice told tales. and Martin was always constrained when he was there, but a perfectly acceptable traditional afternoon in a well-run ship. Now the difference was very great. He could only guess at the causes. The effects, to a man who had spent most of his life at sea, were perfectly evident. The gunroom, as a civilized community, was almost at an end. But much more than their social comfort was at stake. Without good feeling between the officers, effective, willing cooperation was impossible. And without cooperation, a ship could not be run efficiently. Ill blood in wardroom or gunroom was always perceived on the forecastle, and it always upset the hands. Apart from anything else, each set of men had their own particular loyalty. And this ill blood seemed to run in many directions. There was not only the obvious dislike between West and Davidge, but a series of other currents that seemed to affect Pullings as well, and even Martin. At present, however, there was this fine new flow of talk, initiated, he recalled, by Mrs. Oakes. I shall always honour her for saving the feast from sinking with all hands. And even the sullen Davidge had grown quite voluble. Jack had missed the beginning while he reflected upon the situation, upon its possible causes and remedies, upon the ship's inner voice, now increasingly urgent in spite of sails having been taken in, and upon his own duties as a guest. And when he heard Stephen say, "Oh, Spartan, dog more fell than anguish, hunger, or the sea," he called down the table, "What was that, Doctor? Are you talking about the income tax?" "Not at all, at all. We were discussing duels, and when they were by general consent permissible, when they were universally condemned, and when they were absolutely required. Mrs. Oakes asked whether the military code did not oblige the officer who was beaten by Earl Howe to ask for satisfaction, a blow being an intolerable affront. And we all said no, because he was a very old gentleman, and therefore allowed to be a little testy, because his immense deserts excused him almost anything, and because he could be said to have asked pardon by patting the lieutenant on the shoulder and saying, 'Well, so she ain't invincible after all.'" "I'm so ashamed," said Clarissa. "I lived very much out of the world when I was young, and that was one of my two pieces of fashionable wisdom. The other was that if you paid for anything in the shop with a banknote, you must always clearly state its value so that there may be no argument about the change." "How I wish I'd been taught that when I was a boy," said Jack. "Banknotes didn't often come my way, but the first decent prize money I ever saw had one in it, a ten-pounder on Child's, no less, and the shabby fellow at the Keppel's Knob gave me change for five, swearing there wasn't a tenner in the house. I might look in the till if I wished, and if I found a tenner there, I might have it all. But, Doctor, how did the Spartan dog come in?" "It seemed to me to express the state of mind of a deeply injured, furious duellist when he plunges his sword into the opponent's bowels." "May I cut you a trifle of pudding, ma'am?" asked Pullings, moved by the association of ideas. Clarissa might decline, but Captain Aubrey, feeling that he must do honour to the gunroom's feast, already tolerably damped, held out his plate. And now, for the first time, he realised with a pang that a third slice was going to be more of a labour than a delight. "Non sum qualis iram" drifted up from those remote years when he was flogged into at least a remote, nodding acquaintance with Latin. The rest he couldn't recall. It might have had nothing to do with pudding at all, but the effect was the same. "Mr. Martin," he asked, "what is the Latin for pudding? For a pudding of this kind?" "Heaven, sir, I cannot tell," said Martin. "What do you say, Doctor?"
"Sebi confectio discolor," said Stephen.
"Will I pour you a glass of wine, colleague?" "I beg your pardon, sir," said Davidge, standing between Jack and Pullings, "but it'll be eight bells in 2 minutes, and Oakes and I must relieve the gunner." Lord, cried Pulling, so you must, how time flies. But you must drink to the bride and bridegroom first. Come, gentlemen, bumpers, if you please, and no heel traps. Here's to the bride, bowing to Clarissa, and here's to the happy man, bowing to Oakes. They all rose, and swaying on the roll, they cried, Hussay! 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 Stretched out their glasses to Clarissa, crying, Hussay! 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 Again, and then to Oakes, with a final cheer in which all the seamen servants joined. A fine, deep roar. When the party had broken up, Stephen took Padeen forward, and they emptied Reed with a powerful emetic, undressed him, cleaned him, and put him back into his hammock, still three parts drunk and very unhappy. Stephen sat with him for a while after Padeen had carried off the basin, dirty clothes and dressings. Reed had the whole starboard midshipman's berth to himself, immediately opposite the Oakses, and very spacious it looked under the swinging lantern. The surprise had, from early times, been a law unto herself as far as berthing was concerned, and now that she carried no marines and a smaller body of seamen, the carpenter, boatswain and gunner had taken advantage of the elbow room to move themselves into cabins right forward, private triangular snugs, so that now the two midshipmen's berths were comparatively isolated, with the gunroom bulkhead and the ladder to the upper deck aft, the great screened-off space where the crew slept forward, and nothing in the broad passage between them but the captain's pantry, a stout erection the height of the tween decks, 7 feet across and 5 fore and aft. At one time Reed had spoken in a confused, incoherent way about Mrs. Oakes. He had loved her so, he was sure his heart must break. But now he was asleep, even pulse, regular breath. Stephen doused his light and walked quietly out into the gloom of the lower deck. A movement on the far side, the larboard side of the captain's pantry, caught his eye. A dark coat that at once slipped out of sight. It was perhaps a little surprising that the dark coat didn't call out to him, didn't ask after Reed, but he thought nothing of it until he was climbing the ladder by the gunroom door, when he glanced to the left and realised that the man must now be standing against the forward side of the pantry, the only side hidden from the ladder. It would have been much wiser to hurry on through the screen, he reflected, so much less furtive, so much more easily explained in the extremely improbable event of any explanation being called for. He climbed on, grasping the rail with both hands, the ring of his lantern between his teeth, for the surprise was now capering like a wanton, the movement growing stronger as he rose. It had early been laid down that there would be no beating to quarters today, and he found Jack Aubrey gazing out of the windward scuttle with his hands behind his back and a sombre look on his face. He turned, brightening, and said, "Why, there you are, Stephen. A pot of coffee'll be up in a moment if that wicked fellow hasn't upset his kettle again. She's grown a little skittish. You've been looking at Reed, I dare say. How does he do, poor little chap?" "He will survive with the blessing. I suppose when you lose an arm, there's less of you to take up your wine. I know Nelson was very abstemious. And hold up," he cried, "clap onto the locker." He eased Stephen into a chair, saying, "God's my life, Stephen, you absolutely turned a somersault. I hope nothing's broke." "Nothing, I thank you," said Stephen, feeling his head. "But had I not been wearing a wig, Martin would have had a depressed fracture of the skull to deal with. Surely, Jack, that was a very wild, capricious bound." "She'll do it sometimes. I'm afraid, with a cross sea and an increasing breeze that hasn't settled, that varies 3 or 4 points in as many minutes. There are all sorts of platitudes about ships being like women, unpredictable, if you know what I mean." "'Twas a shrewd blow," said Stephen, rubbing the top of his head. Killick came in with the coffee-pot slung in elegant gimbals and two thick, resistant, heavy-weather mugs that had seen service in many a furious sea. He instantly grasped the situation and told Stephen in a rather louder, more didactic voice than usual that he should always keep a weather eye open and have one hand for himself and another for the ship. "Your best new cold wig, too," he said, taking it away. "All crushed and filthy. When we've had our cup, I shall take off my finery and go on deck," said Jack. "I believe the evening will be a little too lively for music, so what do you say to backgammon?"
"With all my heart," said Stephen.
For many years they'd played chess with fairly even fortunes, but they played with such intensity, being extremely unwilling to lose, that in time it came to resemble hard labour rather than amusement. And they being unusually close friends, remorse for beating the other sometimes outweighed the triumph of winning. They'd also played countless games of piquet, but in this case luck ran so steadily in Stephen's direction, good cards and sequences flocked to him in such numbers, that it became dull. And they'd fixed upon backgammon as a game in which the mere throw of the dice played so large a part that it wasn't shameful to lose, but in which there was still enough skill for pleasure in victory. As well as those of the usual kind, they had heavy weather tables in which the men were provided with a peg. And Stephen had set them out long, long before Jack returned, wet, with his hair draggled down the side of his face. "I believe you'll have a quiet night of it," he said. "The breeze has settled into the south-southeast, and steering east by north a half north, we have it rather better than 1.3. Double reef topsails and courses." He walked into the quarter gallery, dried himself, and came out saying, "And if the barometer don't lie, we shall have it for a good while yet. Long forecast, long last, you know. A squall took my hat. A damn good Lox hat. But a breeze like this is welcome to it. Would be welcome to have a dozen more, and with gold lace on, too. I've really been so happy to see the glass sinking, with promise of more to come."
"You conceal your joy with wonderful skill, brother."
"Nay, but I'm happy, uncommon happy. Perhaps I may look a little hipped and feel it, too, having overeaten at your splendid feast, but at the same time, I promise you I am extremely pleased with this blow. It may carry us as far as the Friendly Islands. In any event, I mean to drive the ship and keep all hands busy night and day. Very busy indeed. No idle hands, no goddamn mischief. It's your turn to begin, I believe." By now the solid crash of the seas on the frigate's starboard bow and her motion had both become more steady, and the sweep of white water along her upper works came at regular intervals. To ears accustomed to all the sounds of a 500-ton ship being urged through a rough sea at 9 knots by the force of the wind, the rattle and roll of dice was now clear enough, together with the cries of "Ace and tray! Deuce and sink! Aces, by God!" But after a while, Stephen said, "Brother, your mind is not on the game."
"No," said Jack, "I beg pardon. I'm stupider than usual tonight.
I'd thought it universally true that however much dinner you'd eaten, there was always room for pudding. But now," looking down and shaking his head, "I find it ain't the case. I took a third piece out of compliment to Tom Pullings, and it's with me still. Not that I mean the least fling against your glorious feast, of course. The nobles spread upon my word. Poor dear Tom had an anxious time of it, however. He would have been lost without Mrs. Oakes talking away in that good-natured fashion. How I blessed her! And it was she that set West in motion."
"West? Aye, West.
Tell me, Jack, how much of his account was historically accurate?"
"All the first part, until they were bearing down in line abreast. Though the sequence was a little muddled, and though he didn't say enough about the Charlotte's breaking the French line on the 28th, but then, well, perhaps it was a little fanciful. One tells such things to ladies, you know, like the black fellow in the play in Venice Preserved. He rattled away, too, about fields and floods."
He looked thoughtfully at Stephen, hesitated, and said no more. Stephen said nothing either for a while, but then observed,
pudding. Sure, it starts with pudding or marchpan. Then it's the toss of a coin which fails first. Your hair or your teeth, your eyes or your ears. Then comes impotence, for age gelds a man without hope or reprieve, saving him a mort of anguish. When Stephen had set off for his evening rounds, Jack brought out his half-finished sheet and carried on with his letter to Sophie. The gunroom has at last been able to give its long-overdue feast for the Oakses, thanks to a providential swordfish. He was prime eating, have never tasted a better. And with him we drank a capital light, dry sherry of Stephen's, as sound as a nut, though it's crossed the line in both tropics at least twice. Yet I'm afraid the party was heavy going, and poor Tom Pullings had but a sad time of it. He's never very happy, as you know, when he's obliged to take the head of a table, having, as he says himself, no genteel conversation. It began badly, with at least three officers doing themselves no credit. No, it is true that after a while West gave us a long account of the 1st of June. Martin, to be sure, was properly hospitable, so was Adams. And so, of course, was Stephen when he thought of it. But we should have been nowhere without Mrs. Oakes, who talked away nobly, never letting that deadly silence descend. And it must have been uphill work with three dumb, sullen, unsmiling faces opposite her. I smirked and drank wine all round and topped at the agreeable as much as I could. But as you know very well, my dear, I'm not much gifted that way, particularly as I began to be oppressed by a set of shockingly unpleasant ideas. I did my best to help things along by perpetually passing dishes, helping people to moor, pouring wine, and eating and drinking until I could no more. But what with nausea and the growth of these notions, I was a pretty dismal companion by the end of the meal. They did grow, increasing from a faint, half-serious suspicion to something not far short of certainty. It's the very devil that I cannot speak to Stephen about his messmates. I was in great hopes just now when he asked me whether West's account of the battle was to be taken literally. I had hoped I might lead on from that to the present situation. But when I found that he only wanted to know whether it was sound history, I didn't dare. If I'd asked him, in effect, to peach on his fellow officers, even ever so slightly, he would have brought me up with a round turn, such a round turn. He has a greater contempt for informers than anyone I've ever met. Not that I really want him to peach, but rather to give me the benefit of his lights. He knows more about the gunroom and more about mankind in general than I do, being such a very deep old file. But how to separate peaching and the lights is more than I can tell. For some time now, being taken up with writing notes for Helmholtz Fair, and some pieces of my own, and dealing with estate papers. By the way, Martin has accepted the two vacant livings, and is to have Yarrow when it falls in. I've kept rather to myself, apart from music and backgammon with Stephen. Yet from odd words and exchanges on the quarter-deck, or rather from their tone, I had gathered that there was a certain amount of ill-feeling in the gunroom. But I had no notion of how much or how quickly it had developed until this afternoon. Can you imagine three what are ordinarily called gentlemen sitting in a row at a full-dress dinner with guests and never opening their mouths but to eat? It's true that Oakes, though a young fellow of some family and a passable seaman, is completely devoid of the graces, and that Davidge had fallen down the companion ladder. But it wasn't enough to explain the situation. In any case, the livid bruise on the side of his head was like none I've ever seen given by a fall of that kind. It was much more like a blow with a mallet or a man's fist. And gradually it came to seem more and more probable to me that either Oakes or West had in fact hit him. A very heavy blow indeed, almost a knockout blow. Why, of course, I cannot be sure. But this appears to me to be the explanation. Nobody would call Mrs. Oakes very pretty, but she is certainly good company. As for her having been a convict, which once caused such interest, it's neither here nor there. Aboard ship, though I believe it's the same in prison, it certainly was in the Marshalsea, as you know very well, my dear. Once you've been shut up together for some time, original differences scarcely matter. In The Surprise, it's less obvious because we're nearly all more or less white. But in the Diane, there were black, brown and yellow men, Christians, Jews, Mohammedans, heathens. We'd barely doubled the Cape, though far to the south, before one took no notice. They were all blue with cold anyhow, and they were all Dianes. In the same way, Mrs. Oakes is now a surprise, or close on. And, as I say, kind, good-natured, conversable, and a good listener, interested in their stories of the sea. And it so happens that they are all, except for Davidge, tolerably hideous. Most women would recoil from them, but she, in her good nature, does not. Cousin Diana told me long ago that there was a coxcomb to be found in almost every man, even the most unlikely. And these fellows, I believe, have misinterpreted her kindness as liking of quite another kind, and have grown absurdly jealous of one another. It's not only absurd, but where West and Davidge are concerned, it's also extraordinarily unwise. They both long to be reinstated in the service. It's their dearest wish. And having done well hitherto in The Surprise, they are in a fair road to it. But they have to have my good word, their captain's good word, and my parliamentary influence behind them. What captain is going to speak well of officers who cannot command their passions better than this, let alone use his interest with the ministry for them? During dinner they were talking about duels. Mrs. Oakes had started that hare with the best of intentions, I'm sure, and Davidge, coming out of his heavy stupidity, spoke very eagerly about the impossibility of putting up with an affront. I take what comfort I can from the fact that for a great while the ship has either been sitting still, slowly turning in the placid ocean, or swimming very gently along in light variable airs with the people fishing over the side. The weather has been hot and damp, and nobody has had enough to do. Even at quarters it's mostly dumb show, since with the likelihood of trouble at Oahu I have to husband our powder. But now, thank God, we have a fair breeze, and I shall keep them busy, oh, so busy, driving the ship as hard as I dare so far from stores. I believe it'll grow to be a long-lasting, close-reefed topsail gale, and by the time it's blown itself out, they may have come to their senses. If not, I shall have to take very strong measures. I hear Stephen in the coach, trying to climb into his cot. He's already kicked the chair over twice. He dislikes being helped, however. He's in. I hear the steady creak. In this damp weather, he's taken to wheezing and grumbling like an old dog. And this evening, when the ship pecked on a double crest, he took a most surprising toss, turning completely over on top of his head like a tumbler, quite unhurt. But how he survived so long at sea, I cannot tell. Jack laid this sheet aside to dry. The wet ink glistened in the lamplight, and took up yet another file of estate papers. Presently he found he was reading the same line twice, so he shut everything into his writing desk and went to bed. Lying there, with the fine steady heave of the sea rocking him with a diagonal motion, he mused for a while. Sleep didn't come. Far from it. "It's true that Clarissa Oakes isn't really pretty," he said, "but how I wish she were lying here beside me." A moment later he slipped out of his cot, put on shirt and trousers, and went on deck. A dark, Dark night, with warm rain sweeping across from forward. Four hands at the wheel, West leaning on the barricade amidships, most of the watch under the break of the forecastle. He walked aft and stood there, looking at the glow of the binnacle and the white water racing by under the frigate's lee. And in time, the strong wind and rain blowing his long hair out behind like seaweed and soaking him from head to foot, calmed his spirit.